Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was it like to ride with Bonnie and Clyde? In a two-year crime spree that riveted newspaper readers in the early 30s, Dallas natives Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow seemed to embody the frustration of depression-weary Americans as they targeted bankers and storekeepers, often associated with the privations of the unemployed. But even before their murders of two young police officers turned the tide of public opinion against them, Bonnie and Clyde's wild adventures were far more humble in reality than their instant celebrity led Americans to believe. Author Jeff Gwynn found that out when he uncovered source material never before reported about Bonnie and Clyde. He is the former books editor and senior writer for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. His new book is called Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
Reading the book, we get this sense that their fame was as much a product of when they committed their crimes as the crimes themselves. Will you talk a little bit about that?
What's amazing about Bonnie and Clyde is how they were the first modern media icons, really, in America. Their timing was perfect. Their ability as criminals was non-existent. They were maybe the most incompetent crooks ever to become famous in America. They mostly failed when they tried to rob banks. They would hit little mom-and-pop grocery stores and gas stations. Sometimes they were so broke they had to break into gum machines for meal money. But they did these things just during the height of the Depression, when the public was anxious for entertainment. The newspaper business was in jeopardy. I know it's hard to imagine an America where newspapers are failing all over the place because of a fading economy. But the newspapers needed some kind of stories. They built up the will-o'-the-wisp bandit Clyde Barrow and his gorgeous accomplice, you know, the sexy Bonnie Parker. There were wire services for the first time, which means that pictures of Bonnie goofing around posing with a cigar in her mouth could be published in a Joplin newspaper one day when the photos were discovered and be in every newspaper in America the next. At the same time, readers were starting to think of banks as the bad guys, the government as evil. So we had a situation where America wanted gangster entertainment. They wanted a little sex. I mean, here was an unmarried young couple running around together. And it worked. It worked for about a year and a half. And then when the public started to get weary of them, they descended in popularity. And they died, as they always expected to, in gunfire and in a very bloody, violent way.
What kind of lives did they have before they met one another?
This area, during that time when Bonnie and Clyde were growing up, is crucial to understanding them. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is that most of us, if we think about Bonnie and Clyde and their background, think they sort of emerged full-blown when Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway decided to star as them in a movie. Bonnie and Clyde grew up in West Dallas, which I'm sure many of your listeners know was considered one of the worst slums in America at the time. You know, it's on the other side of the Trinity River. It's unincorporated marsh. And it was a place where young people were locked into the economic position they were born into. Clyde Barrow was the son of the poorest of the poor. His father, Henry, was a junk man. Clyde himself worked in factories in West Dallas for a dollar a day. Bonnie Parker was the daughter of a proud widow named Emma who thought that her family was special but found out clearly the rest of the world didn't share that opinion. A bright girl was Bonnie, won spelling bees in school, but there was no reason for her even to bother graduating. In those days, a poor girl in West Dallas became either a waitress, a maid, maybe a sales clerk, or a prostitute, and Bonnie tried a couple of those professions, frankly. They had no hope staying where they were, following the law, being good citizens. And as we all know, when young people feel desperate, when they feel hemmed in, a lot of times they make some pretty bad choices. And Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker made the conscious decision to become criminals. They knew it would not last forever. They expected that they would die as they did. But because otherwise their futures were so bleak, it was an exchange they were willing to make.
It's interesting to me that both of them came from poor but decent families. They were not raised with the assumption that they could do whatever they wanted to do.
Not really, but it's also true that people who lived in the nice areas of Dallas referred to West Dallas as the devil's back porch and assumed that everybody who lived there was probably harboring thieves if they weren't thieves themselves. There was the opportunity to steal cars and so forth, and that got Clyde going. You've got to remember, this is also the time that the talkie movies are first out there, magazines with pictures of people in nice suits. So the young people, for the first time, who didn't have anything, were always being shown the things they would want to have. Now, both families were very religious. Clyde's mother really was a religious fundamentalist who would sort of beat Jesus into her children when they were younger.
Which clearly does not work.
at least not in these cases. But people were shocked, who were members of the Barrow Gang over the couple years that Clyde and Bonnie were out there, that both of them would say their nightly prayers. I mean, they still would get down on their knees and ask Jesus to bless Mama and Daddy and their families and so forth.
Makes you think of The Sopranos.
Well, to them, as with a lot of criminals, there's no contradiction in saying you're religious and at the same time you're breaking the law because you feel as though you were forced to break the law. Clyde always believed that he wasn't going to be allowed to go straight, and therefore, why not go ahead and do whatever he wanted to do?
And he had a really tough time when he was first taken to prison as a very young man for stealing cars.
Oh, my God. And this is something that people never take into consideration. Please understand that in no way do I or my book say it's okay that they killed people, that they had this crime spree. That's unforgivable. But we also need to understand why they might have the attitudes they did. Clyde went to prison in 1930 for car theft. And he deserved to go to prison for car theft. He was convicted on 7 counts and was probably guilty of 700. But he's still a young kid. He's small and scrawny, 5'5½", 127 pounds. And he is sent to the worst hellhole in the abusive Texas criminal prison system, and that's Easton Prison Farm, where he's thrown in with some of the most brutal convicts anywhere. And for a year, almost, Clyde was continually beaten and raped by a building tender, another convict who was given supervisory powers over the rest of the prisoners. That was the first man Clyde Barrow killed. And he did it to try to protect himself, to save himself. The workload there, the prisoners out in the field were treated like slaves. Easton Prison Farm was known as the Bloody Ham because so many prisoners using axes or hose would cut off their own feet or hands, hoping that they would then be judged unfit to work in the fields and get an easier job inside the prison. Clyde Barrow, January 1932, cut off 2 of his own toes on his left foot, and he was crippled and limped ever since, to get out of working in the field. And typical of Clyde's unfortunate career, the day after he mutilates himself, he gets the news that the governor has just pardoned him and he was going to be able to walk out of prison anyway.
How did he manage to stay out of prison after having committed that murder?
He was an inmate at the time, killed another inmate, and he was working in collaboration with yet another prisoner named Aubrey Scally, who was in prison for life, and he cut a deal with Scally. Scally did not like Ed Crowder, the trustee who had raped Clyde, either. So Clyde would have to try to kill Crowder. If he succeeded, Scally would take the fall, say he was the one that committed the murder, since he couldn't be sentenced to another life term anyway and have it make a difference, and Clyde would go free. So that's what happened, and a grand jury even found Scally not guilty, figuring Crowder was such a monster, Scally must have been protecting himself. But again, it's just an example. Clyde Barrow, even then, was willing to kill when he felt he had no other choice.
So you have Clyde Barrow fresh out of prison, and then he meets this teenage girl who had a history of picking bad men.
Bonnie Elizabeth Parker, in some ways one of the most sympathetic characters in American history, and at the same time, maybe somebody who made some of the worst decisions involving men of any young woman in our history.
It is hard to decide how to feel about her, I should say.
It's hard to decide how to feel about both of them. I mean, you can understand where they're coming from, but you can't condone the things they did. Bonnie grows up in great poverty, too. She's a bright girl, but she's not even going to finish high school. Nothing special can happen to her. When she's 15, she does the one thing most poor girls in West Dallas can do. She gets married. She marries a guy named Roy Thornton, good-looking, big guy, who immediately begins to abuse her, disappears for long periods of time, finally deserts her, and ends up in prison himself because he's a thief. Bonnie apparently loves bad boys. Before Clyde goes to prison, Bonnie meets him at a party. There's instant attraction. One thing Clyde loves about her is he's sensitive about his height. He's so short with previous girlfriends, if he takes pictures with him, he has to jump up on a curb so he'll look taller. But Bonnie's tiny. I mean, I'm sure a lot of folks will understand when I say she wore a size 2 junior petite dress. That's how small she was. And she means to be faithful to Clyde while he's in prison, but she gets bored and he has to win her back when he gets out. But she throws in with him. And maybe everything else about their relationship and their career as criminals are exaggerations. But theirs was a genuine love story. They each had a chance many times to leave the other one and have a little better chance at things. They would never take it. And of course, Bonnie ends up the last year they're out there as a cripple herself because of Clyde's reckless driving. Very few people remember Bonnie didn't walk the last year of her life. When Clyde crashed a car in West Texas, the battery cracked open. Her leg was coated with battery acid. It drew up, as her sister Billie Jean said later, and Bonnie could only hop the last year of her life. She had to be carried places. And yet these are the people that are presented by the media as glamorous, you know, just romantic Bonnie and Clyde. They're living in their car like animals. They camp by streams so they can take baths.
Is there any evidence, Jeff, that they disagreed on a regular basis about anything they did? Being devoted to one another is one thing, but did they agree on every MO?
Oh, geez, no. they traveled
with... It's a setup.
I understand, and I'm thank you for it, because it allows me to segue to the next thing. Bonnie and Clyde traveled with a series of members of the Barrow Gang who would come and go, and we have lots of eyewitness accounts. Bonnie was feisty, and Clyde certainly expected to be the boss, and Bonnie was not always willing to be bossed. They would argue. Sometimes those arguments would become physical. But they would always make up and keep on going together. And, of course, the people they ran with, just it's a colorful, eclectic crew. You have Clyde's brother, Buck, very happy-go-lucky. Poor Blanche Barrow, Buck's wife, who is one of the most misunderstood people in history. And W.D. Jones, that great criminal mastermind, who's 16 years old and so afraid of the dark that when they're able to stop in motels for the night, he has to sleep with Bonnie and Clyde so the boogeyman won't get him. These are the kinds of brilliant criminals that we're talking about in the Barrow Gang.
How did they go about planning when they did try to plan a heist?
Well, first of all, plan is not a word that one would associate with the Barrow Gang. Generally, they would try things on the spur of the moment and bungle things entirely. The few times they did try to plan, they didn't plan very well. For instance, once Clyde decided he would send Bonnie in to Case Bank, and Bonnie had never been at a bank, so she didn't know what to tell him.
Jeff Gwynn is my guest. His brand new book is called Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to get on the line now to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author Jeff Gwynn is my guest. His new book is called Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I have to say, Jeff, I think the most fascinating element of the book to me is discovering that Bonnie Parker wanted to be a poet and, in fact, wrote a lot of not very good but very interesting verse.
Bonnie had a lot of ambition. I mean, she was not a young woman who intended to just stay where she was in life. Her original goals in life, as announced to her family, were one of two things. She wanted to be on Broadway, or she wanted to be one of those very ubiquitous multi-billionaire poets that America likes to nurture so well. And neither was going to happen. But Bonnie did write a lot of poetry. We have some samples in the book of some of her poetry that people may not have heard of before. Her first real criminal adventure with Clyde did not end well out in Kaufman County, where their car got stuck in mud while they were being pursued. They tried to ride away bareback on mules that bucked them into the mud. They were ultimately surrounded, and Clyde did the courageous thing by leaving Bonnie and promising he'd come back to get her. But Bonnie's in jail for 3 months waiting for the grand jury to show up. And during that time, she actually writes 10 poems that she kind of calls a collection called Poetry from the Other Side. And it proves that Bonnie had wonderful handwriting.
I was going to say, it's incredible penmanship.
It is incredible penmanship, kind of a stuttering sense of rhythm, and an inordinate fondness for quotation marks. Every other word is set off by that. But some of the poems are very interesting. You've got Suicide Sal, which is about a trusting young woman who's betrayed by a criminal who wins her love and then deserts her. I wonder who she was thinking about at the time. And then there's an amazing one called The Prostitute's Convention, which is nothing more really than a list of all the corners, street corners in Dallas.
Yeah, it reads like a Dallas Maps Go with prostitutes attached.
Yeah, and it includes a lot of things about specialties, preferences, and drug use. And there's been some thought that Bonnie herself, during some of her more desperate times in West Dallas, may have turned a couple tricks, which would not have been entirely unusual. The wages paid to women at that time in the slum factory jobs were so awful that during this time when a New York union organizer came down to try to say that, you know, there has to be something to protect these women, her argument was that as many as a third of them were having to turn to prostitution just to feed their families because there was so little money coming in. So Bonnie wrote this poetry, and it disappeared for any number of years. We found it in the possession of a collector in England who was kind enough after so much time to allow us to actually reproduce it. So in the book, you can not only read Bonnie's poetry, you can see her handwriting. And Clyde stole a typewriter for her. And she would sit in the back of their stolen cars as they drove along, and she would type out her poems. She really fancied herself a poet, and of course the title of this book is taken from her most famous poem of all.
You know, what is interesting to me, of course, they stole car after car, in part to get away, and Clyde had a preference for Fords.
Oh, yes, always Ford V8s.
And he wrote to Henry Ford, or he may have.
That's questionable. Clyde had a great sense of humor, and Henry Ford did receive a letter purportedly from Clyde Barrow saying what a wonderful car that Ford built and how Clyde always tried to steal them. Clyde's family said afterward that he could not have written that letter because it was signed Clyde Champion Barrow, and Clyde's real name was Clyde Chestnut Barrow. I think it's kind of iffy whether he wrote it or not, but Henry Ford thought he did. He actually had his secretary draft a thank you note and sent it back to Clyde, General Delivery in Tulsa, where the original letter was mailed from. I would be surprised if Clyde wrote that letter.
Did that do anything for the sale of a Ford V8?
Well, they were already selling as many of them as they could manufacture. And again, the Ford V8 is a real key to why Clyde, who was so incompetent, was able to actually be at large for 2 years. In those days, most of the local lawmen were maybe farmers or businessmen who'd gone broke and were voted into this job by their neighbors. And these folks would have to provide their own guns, which usually might be .22 pistols they used for shooting varmints, and their own cars, which quite often were farm trucks held together with baling wire. So then you get Clyde Barrow, who's driving powerful Ford V8s and is perfectly willing to do 80 miles an hour down dirt roads. And Clyde would break into National Guard armories, and he would be armed with Browning automatic rifles. So in almost every case, Clyde could drive his way out of trouble. And if he couldn't do that, he could shoot his way out.
I think about, though, Jeff, this is such a funny thing, but what it must have taken for them with all this gear. They had weapons, they had the stolen typewriter, they had clothes, they had cans of food. Every time they stole a new car, they would have to switch everything into the new vehicle.
Well, they would do that, and to try to keep from doing that as often as possible, they kept a supply of license plates. And you can even tell the story of how they learned from their mistakes from photographs taken. They loved to pose for photographs, and in the early ones, you'll see, they'd pose by their cars, and the license plate would be exposed. And they were actually tracked a couple times because of that. So in the later photographs, when they'd figured that out, you'll see they always put a coat or a hat over the license plate so no one could see it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jeff Gwynn is my guest. The new book is called Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. Let's go to Robert in Plano. Hello, Robert.
Hi. I'm appreciating the show. It's just fun to listen to. I know it's a lot of people these days romanticize Bonnie and Clyde, and I just had a quick comment that your guest could share about. But, you know, the more I read about them, they really were cold-blooded cop killers. And I was really appalled at some of the things Bonnie said after they killed police officers, just some grotesque language, laughing and mocking about how they died. And a lot of people romanticize them, especially in this kind of pseudo-depression era we're in. That it was romantic, but really they were cold-blooded murderers that most of us would be horrified to have ever met, and I'll take it off the line.
Thanks for your call.
I think I might disagree with some of that. Near as I can tell, the Barrow Gang or Clyde personally were directly involved in 11 killings, and believe me, that's indefensible, that's horrible. But only two of those were premeditated, both prison trustees who had been abusing prisoners. Clyde was hot-tempered, he panicked easily, and he put himself in situations where people died. That's wrong. On the other hand, a lot of the stories that Bonnie laughed about people being killed and so forth came well after the fact. There was one double homicide on April 1st, 1934, just outside Grapevine, Easter Sunday, when two highway patrolmen on motorcycles were killed by the Barrow Gang. In fact, Bonnie, Clyde, and their henchman Henry Methven were parked by the side of the road. Clyde would often, if he was confronted by lawmen and couldn't get away from them, would simply take them hostage, drive a little way, and release them. He meant to do that with these two patrolmen. Henry Methven misunderstood when Clyde said, "Let's take them." He shot one, and Clyde, seeing that there was no alternative now, shot the other. A witness, an eyewitness who was later discredited, claimed that Bonnie stood over one of the bodies, laughing as she pumped shots into him while his head bounced like a rubber ball off the pavement. And ballistics tests after the guns were recovered a couple months later proved that, in fact, it was Henry Methven who did that, not Bonnie. But the rumor spread from there that suddenly Bonnie, far from being a cute, sexy, fun girl, was a cold-blooded killer who enjoyed murdering someone. Yes, they killed people. That's unforgivable. They put themselves in situations that they should not have put themselves in. But I do believe most of the time it was something that happened more by accident than premeditation.
Before these officers were killed, when a lot of Americans were still following with interest, if not delight, their adventures, did people in the parts of the country where they were known to be fear them? Or did most individuals tend to assume, well, they're not after my kind, they're going after a banker?
There were a lot more poor people than rich people, and Clyde and Bonnie often would be put up for the night by someone. They were helped by any number of civilians who I think pretty much kind of – they were acting out what a lot of Americans wanted to do. Were they greatly feared? Towards the end of their careers, particularly after the Grapevine shooting, when it became popular mythology that maybe they did in fact kill for no particular reason, maybe then – but I would say they were mostly supported by the public for quite a bit of their two-year rampage, so to speak.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Terry in Dallas. Hi, Terry.
Hello. Good day. Enjoying the show. Growing up around Dallas, I had relatives that knew the Barrows and Parker, Bonnie and Clyde. Also friends. I've hunted myself. I've hunted with Red Parker. I found them to be very good people. I'm sure they went wrong. No doubt about that. But there is a great myth around a lot of that. And I'm going to inject something here, and I don't elaborate on it. There were a lot of people mimicking them. They call them copycats. Also, we like to keep under wraps that there were other desperados here. But I have a question, because I don't know a lot. Because there are the myths. My son still asks me questions about them. There was a loose gang. The only solid parts of the gang was Clyde's brother. But these people were in and out. And I understood, in fact, they weren't impoverished, that is, the Barrows, and did have a gas station in West Dallas and some property. But the loose gang would meet around about there. And my question was there a member of that gang, supposedly, you know, all these things come together and go apart, it was a driver for Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker. And again, did they own property? Were they impoverished? And
We got it. Thanks for your call, Terry.
Clyde always insisted on driving himself. That was one of the things that was important to him. He always wanted to be the boss. There were an awful lot of different temporary members of the Barrow gang who would drift in and out. You're sure correct about that. Clyde's father, at one point, with the help of his couple of his children, was able to buy some property off Eagle Ford Road, which is now Singleton Boulevard. And, in fact, the gas station or the shack that they had there still stands if you want to go drive by sometime. They would Bonnie and Clyde loved their families. They would come in risking their own freedom often, several times a month, to come visit them. And they'd usually just drive down the road in front of the gas station and toss out a Coke bottle with a note in it about where they wanted to meet. So Clyde's father did own two lots right next to each other in the very poorest part of town. The gas station didn't make enough money to keep the family going. It was really more of a trading post. The Barrows dug a well and sold water by the gallon. They had a phone line, and they charged for use of the phone. And also Henry Barrow, Clyde's daddy, was a bootlegger. An interesting thing, we gained access to a couple unpublished family memoirs, including one from Clyde's little sister Marie that had never been part of any book or publication before. And Marie never denied that her brother killed people, but she tried to deny that her daddy made and sold bootleg whiskey. She thought that was a tremendous sin. And I've never quite figured out why one was considered worse than the other. But Marie never wanted anyone to believe that her father sold whiskey. Sorry, he did.
And Bonnie was inordinately fond of that bootleg whiskey.
Bonnie, I think, was a borderline alcoholic. And one of the things she would do to try to maintain her image, which was very important to her, she hated the fact people thought she smoked cigars and at every opportunity would try to get that word out. And if she'd been drinking, what she would do is take lemon peel, bits of lemon peel, and chew it to get sort of a lemon scent around her mouth rather than a whiskey scent. The police caught on to that, and a few times that's how they knew that the Barrow gang must have been someplace. Bonnie drank heavily, and Clyde used to say he let her drink as much as she wanted to because she'd had such a hard life, and particularly in the last year of her life, she was in so much pain from her leg.
So he wasn't a drinker?
He drank some, but with Bonnie, she would always warn him the laws might be on us any time, so he was always very careful about that. She was not.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Victor in Richardson who says, did Bonnie and Clyde have a sexual relationship? The movie portrayed it as awkward at best.
This is one of my favorite stories to tell. Clyde's family.
This book has everything. It's got sex. It's got violence.
Their story has everything, and that's what makes it so fascinating to us 75 years after they died. The movie Bonnie and Clyde is tremendous entertainment, but it's probably 95% historically inaccurate. Clyde Barrow is portrayed in the movie by Warren Beatty as, shall we say, having certain problems in the romance department. There's a wonderful, wonderful Bonnie and Clyde scholar right here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area named John Neal Phillips, who's done a couple great books on them. And John Neal set out to find out the truth about this. Before Bonnie Parker, Clyde had a longtime girlfriend named Eleanor Williams. And John Neal Phillips was able to find this woman, now a sort of elderly lady, shall we say. And he didn't directly put the question to her, but she could tell what he wanted to know. And finally she said, here's the thing. He didn't have any trouble at all. And she made it clear she spoke as an expert.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Meridian and speak with Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Interestingly enough, in the early 60s, being raised in East Texas and northern Louisiana, we heard about the Bonnie and Clyde and gangs and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, there was Frank and Jesse and the Cole Youngers and all that. Do you think there was any kind of influence to keep on going due to the success or failure of both campaigns? Just out of curiosity.
Clyde Barrow, when he was a kid, his heroes were Billy the Kid and Jesse James. He always wanted to be like them. And when you think about it, mythologically as well as in a historical context, Bonnie and Clyde and the whole gangster era sort of is the natural evolution from the outlaws of the Old West who rode horses. Clyde was so fascinated by Jesse James, his family would refer to Clyde as Mr. Howard in code, which was Jesse's pseudonym.
Jeff Gwynn is my guest. His new book is called Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. We'll return to our conversation, and you can call us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former books editor and senior writer of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Jeff Gwynn. He's an author now, and his latest one is called Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. How interested were their families in fixing their image after they were both killed?
After they were killed, the families initially had a terrible time. All the Parkers and Barrows and various relatives and friends were hauled into court, charged with harboring fugitives, and received jail sentences ranging from 2 years to teenage Marie got to sit in jail for an hour. As the years went on, the families, I think, tried to step back from all the controversy. In fact, Bonnie's niece, who was named for her, changed her name so that people wouldn't necessarily associate her with the ubiquitous Bonnie Parker, particularly after the movie came out in 1968. And the families hated the movie, and almost all of them sued the studio for misrepresenting things. Their cases were thrown out of court because they hadn't been identified by name, except the widow of Frank Hamer, the Texas Ranger retired captain, actually won a lawsuit against the movie because it had shown some things that weren't true about her husband. But the families wanted to escape it. And I'm very grateful to the surviving members of the family now who took some time to help me with the book and, in fact, give me some family documents and photographs because they really want to see the record set straight, too. Again, they don't condone the things that Bonnie and Clyde did, but they're happy that there may be a chance for some context to the story for the first time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next question comes from Liz in Bedford. Hello, Liz.
Hi. I have a question. I used to work at a bakery in on Main Street in Grapevine. Around the time of Bonnie and Clyde, it was a barber shop. And the rumor is that it's the original door of the original building. And the rumor is that there's a gunshot through the door, and that it was made by Bonnie and Clyde. I was wondering if that is possible.
What do you know about that, Jeff?
Well, anything is possible. Clyde and Bonnie drove an awful lot of places, and I'm sure did a whole lot of intemperate things. But it's also important to remember that the whole time they were out there, they were being blamed for things that happened when they were thousands of miles away, too. They very rarely, I think, would have set off a gun in the middle of town for no reason at all. They would want to get in and out as quickly and as quietly as they could. Again, that certainly could have happened. I'm sure it's a great story, and it brings a lot of pleasure to a lot of people. And I can't tell you it didn't happen. I can tell you I would be surprised if it did.
What were the circumstances surrounding, and you mentioned Frank Hamer a moment ago. This is the former Texas Ranger who was finally brought on to take them down. It didn't take him all that long at all once he was on the case.
As soon as there was a dedicated professional who took a pragmatic approach, they were done for. Bonnie and Clyde, in January of 1934, were involved in helping out on a jailbreak in Easton Prison. And at that time, it was supposed to be impregnable. And the superintendent of the prison system, Lee Simmons, decided that they just couldn't let something like that go. Bonnie and Clyde had to be stopped. That was it. With the governor's permission, he hired retired Ranger Captain Frank Hamer, who was maybe the most famous lawman in Texas, to go after them. Hamer very methodically tracked them, learned their different routes that they liked to take. Bonnie and Clyde's final henchman was a kid from Louisiana named Henry Methvin. Henry's family was ready to betray them. And in fact, one of the great things about this book is we found some tapes of the Methvin family talking about how that happened that had never actually been made public before. Hamer organized a posse. Bonnie and Clyde were certainly gulled into being where he wanted them to be. They were destroyed in 16 seconds. Clyde was killed with the first shot. Bonnie had just time to scream before they shot her. And one of the deputies, Ted Hinton, who was a member of the posse, told people later, when all was said and done, they were nothing but a pile of wet rags. And that's pretty much true.
And their car was taken around on the state fair circuit.
Well, there have been three supposed death cars, but the real one was rented by its owner to the crime doctor, as the gentleman called himself, who toured state fairs with the car with a slideshow, mostly Clyde's mugshots, Clyde's father and mother, and the father of John Dillinger, the whole theory being crime doesn't pay. And that went on for any number of years. And again, just as we were talking, the lady said, was that gunshot in the door from them? There's many, many people who feel they saw the car, and I'm sure some of them did. It's now property of a casino just outside of Las Vegas.
Only in America.
Only in America.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Mark in Dallas. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Just speaking to your comment just then, only in America, is this a uniquely American thing, which is, you know, the sort of societal need to glorify criminals? I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks.
I think America's always been fascinated by the gun culture. When you think of who some of our cultural icons have been, if you go back to Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, you know, the flintlock rifles out there in the frontier, Buffalo Bill Cody, one of the first self-made celebrities, Jesse James, Billy the Kid. But we've also got to remember that we tend to try to glorify the understandable evil. In the Depression, you've got people angry with the banks, angry with the government, and here are Bonnie and Clyde who take on aspects in folks' minds maybe of Robin Hood. Now, Robin Hood's from England. In any society, I think there's always a fascination with the powerless, somehow a couple people empowering themselves to take on the big shots and make them suffer a little bit. I don't know that that's uniquely American. Maybe the gun part of the culture is. That's not a bad observation.
Let's go next on the phones to Arlington and speak with Steve. Hey, Steve.
Hey. I was wondering if Clyde Barrow was related to any of the Barrows on High Island in South Texas.
There were lots of branches of the Barrow family, and that may well be. I only know of Barrows right now out in Sunnydale.
What were those initial calls like when you would try and get in contact with living relatives?
I was lucky in that I had some folks who were helping me make contact. Dallas is a community particularly, well, Dallas and Fort Worth. I would never leave out Tarrant County. In this case, it was a lot of folks mostly living in Dallas County who are very respectful of local history and try to learn as much as they can about it. And in meeting a few of them, they sort of acted as buffers. And now I count Buddy Barrow Williams, Clyde's nephew, and Raylene Linder, Bonnie's niece, as very good friends of mine. In fact, when I did my first signing for the book at Borders on Preston Road here in Dallas, they joined me. And when we did the Q&A, we actually had members of the Barrow and Parker families helping out with that.
Do they bear any resemblance to their forebears?
Well, let me just say this. Raylene is a beautiful lady, just like her Aunt Bonnie, and Buddy Barrow Williams has a little bit of a rascal in him, just like his step-uncle Clyde.
Does it surprise you that people turned on them so quickly after having embraced them so wholeheartedly?
That's what we do in America huh. with our celebrities. Think about it. How many people that we choose to turn into icons remain pristine the whole time? Part of the fun, I think, in our societies, we build somebody up, then we get the chance to tear them down. By the time of the Easter Sunday shootings in Grapevine, Bonnie and Clyde had been in the news, they'd been national for about a year. Before that, they were more Texas rumors than national icons. And that's pretty much the attention span when you think about it. When they died, there was some backlash against Hamer, that there was an ambush, they weren't given the chance to give up, and particularly that a woman had been slaughtered like that. But I think it was inevitable at some time people would want to see them torn down. That's simply the nature of the beast.
Such a poignant story about the police officers that they killed. One of them was engaged to be married, and his fiancée wore her wedding gown to his funeral.
Right, Marie Tullis. And the stories in the paper, and this was the first time the victims of Bonnie and Clyde were humanized and made the focus of the story. And even then, of the two highway patrolmen, it was the rookie rather than the veteran who got all the attention. But his fiancée, Marie, went to the funeral in the wedding gown that she would have worn 3 weeks later. And they wrote stories about the furnished apartment the young couple had bought. And so for the first time, here we're being presented a Bonnie and Clyde that not only robbed from the rich, but robbed the hope of other relatively poor people. And that helped change things. But as I said before, that's the nature of it. We build people up, and then part of the sport is tearing them down. And I don't think that's changed in all these years since.
Is there any doubt in your mind that the only way to take them out was to take them out, as opposed to trying to apprehend them alive and bring them to justice?
If Clyde Barrow was anything, he was stubborn. He was determined never to go back to prison, and he meant it. He had killed an awful lot of people trying to get away. He would have done whatever he could to get away again. Bonnie Parker had many chances to leave his side, even at the end. Texas juries were notorious for thinking women were just silly creatures who couldn't think for themselves, and if she had turned herself in, a lawyer would have presented her as just this weak-willed girl that had been taken over by this Machiavellian Clyde, and she probably would have gotten a fairly lenient sentence. She refused to do that. If Hamer had not killed them that day, he would have had to do it somewhere else.
What's your assessment, Jeff, as a journalist, of the stories that were written about them that proved to be mostly or entirely false? Were they fabricated by eyewitnesses who got carried away, or were they made up by reporters who needed a story?
Combination of both. At that time, newspapers were dying out all across the country, and particularly in Texas. Some kind of stories were needed to get readers' minds off their trouble and make them invest a nickel to get the paper. Now, what's going to sell those papers? Stories about more bank foreclosures, stories about more unemployment figures, or a really colorful story about this Romeo and Juliet of bandits who've done some amazing thing and gotten away again. If it was not a deliberate conspiracy, it was a welcome one. It gave everybody what they wanted, including Bonnie and Clyde, who every time the police would find one of the cars they'd abandoned, they would have the latest true crime magazines and newspapers with stories about themselves in it. Everybody loved it, including the Barrow Gang.
They were following their own headlines.
Loving it.
How recognizable were their faces?
For the last year, very. They posed for a lot of pictures when they didn't have to that fell into the hands of the authorities. And again, because of wire services, this is something that hadn't existed before. A picture could run all across the country.
And they sent their own pictures in a couple of cases.
Not necessarily, but they certainly left photos where they could be found. Mm-hmm. And again, the whole idea was they wanted to be famous. They wanted to be important. They wanted to count for a little while. And the media was happy to oblige.
Do you think the culture that allows almost anybody to get themselves on a reality show who really wants to be famous will preclude this sort of behavior in the future?
No, I think it will encourage it. If mm-hmm. Bonnie Parker were alive today, her idol would be Kelly Clarkson, you know, a small-town Texas girl who goes on national TV, sings, and becomes a big star. Bonnie would have seen herself in that. Clyde would have loved to have been on Survivor, and by golly, he'd have done anything to be the survivor. There might have been a few bodies laying around.
What does it say about us as a society that, you know, 60 years later, we're still really into this story?
I think when we study Bonnie and Clyde, when we write about them, when we read about them, what's most important is not even who they were, but what they represent. In this society, there is always going to be a yearning for celebrity on the part of a lot of people. And at different cycles in our history, we play to that. We make it much more possible. Quite often it's in an economic downturn when people need some kind of hope that maybe something magical will happen to me and I'll get famous, I'll be important. And now we're in a time when newspapers are declining, looking for sensational stories, when television, the media is playing up ordinary people suddenly thrust into the limelight. Violence is endemic and growing in this country. When people feel hopeless, that happens. And I think we can look back at Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker, and maybe we can see some warning signs.
Jeff Gwynn has been my guest. He is an author now and a former books editor and senior writer for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. The new book is called Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde. Jeff, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
This is always fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.